Spring into action with the biggest fly fishing gear sale of the season. Jackson Hole Fly Company is thrilled to announce their spectacular 25% off anniversary sale. They are inviting all of us to celebrate with them. Whether you're a seasoned angler or just starting out, there's never been a better time to upgrade your equipment and save big. Are you looking for a rugged, waterproof sling pack or backpack to keep your gear dry throughout all the adventures this year? They have you covered. Are you in search of a new carbon fiber landing net? Top quality fly boxes, essential gear like fly lines and leaders? They have all that and more. This is your chance to grab some incredible deals and make the fishing season unforgettable. Don't wait. Dive into the savings today. Head over to jacksonholeflycompany.com and take advantage of this limited time sale. Coming up next on the Wet Fly Swing podcast.
That was amazing. I mean, it was like almost life-changing. I know that sounds precious to say, but I told a lot of people that was the hardest thing I've ever written, just by sheer nature of how much work it took, one, to catch fish, and two, just that place and kind of how controversial it has become, I guess I'll say.
That was Joseph Jackson taking us into the Yakutat, rainbows, pike, grayling, and steelhead, heading back into Alaska today on The Swing.
Welcome to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show, where you discover tips, tricks, and tools from the leading names in fly fishing today.
Hey, how you doing today? Thank you for stopping by the show. We've got a big week next week as we are heading into the Euro Nymphing School giveaway. Mark your calendars. We've got a big event next week, a chance to win a trip, a bunch of products, big pack for this big trip, including a killer Euro Nymphing rod. All good to go. Check it out next week. Today's episode is sponsored by Eastern Idaho's Yellowstone Teton Territory, Idaho's most renowned zone for fly fishing. From the Henry's Fork to the South Fork of the Snake and all the high alpine lakes and streams in between, Yellowstone Teton Territory provides anglers and other outdoor enthusiasts with all the information they need to plan their next big trip. You can visit wetflyswing.com/Teton right now to get the full list of outfitters, lodges, fly shops, and all kinds of inspiration to get you started on your next trip to Eastern Idaho. That's Teton, T-E-T-O-N, wetflyswing.com/Teton. Today's episode is sponsored by Chota Outdoor, legendary comfort and equipment you can trust. Chota insists on the finest materials and craftsmanship. You can assure you have the highest standards of quality. You'll feel in control of the elements in your Chota gear. Every product is solidly backed with a no-nonsense warranty against defects. Head over to wetflyswing.com/Chota right now. That's Chota, C-H-O-T-A, to support this podcast and the Chota Outdoor family right now. Joe Jackson is on the podcast to take us into the last frontier and focus on Alaska by car. We hear about some of the less-known places you can add to your itinerary if you're heading up to the 49th state. We dig into the species list and best times and places to hit while on your road trip, and we find out how he's going to accomplish his goal as a professional writer. He's got some good stuff going here, a book we talk about today, and a bunch of tips on hitting Alaska if you're heading up by car. All right, let's jump into the Parks Highway and dig back into the road system that is Alaska. Here we go, Joe Jackson from josephjacksonwriter.com. How's it going, Joe?
Doing well, Dave. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for coming here. We just wanted to clarify, we've had another Joe Jackson on the podcast in the past. You're the second here. We talked poppers with Sergeant Bass Fisher. So just for clarification, you don't tie poppers, right? Or do you?
I occasionally will, but mine are nowhere near as good as the other Mr. Jacksons.
Yeah, right. No, it's pretty funny because it's, I mean, I have a common name as well. So there's a bazillion, you know what I mean, Dave Stewart's out there as well. So it's... It's good. Do you know, I mean, like where you're coming from? Remind me again before we jump into this, where are you at now and you know, where have you been living the last few years?
Yeah, of course. So I grew up in southeastern Wyoming, and then I came up to Fairbanks, Alaska for college and then spent a few years up there. And then my wife and I just recently moved down here to Anchorage, Alaska. So that's where I'm at currently.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. So you're out there and one of those stories you hear people that kind of head up to Alaska and they just stick around and and don't ever come back down to the lower 48. What's kept you there? What was the biggest thing that's kept you there?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's funny because my wife, most of her family is from Minnesota. I mean, she came to Alaska when she was 6 months old. Her parents fell in love with it. So this is all she really knows, but she definitely has more of her family base down there. And then of course mine is Wyoming, Colorado. So it's almost like we've always been looking for a reason to go back down there, you know, to be closer to family, but for whatever reason, we just can't leave Alaska. I think a lot of it's the freedom of being up here because, you know, we'll take visits down to back home, I guess, Wyoming, Minnesota, that sort of thing. And it's like, you can't just, in some places you can, but you can't just go hike in the mountains to your heart's content. You can't just follow streams to your heart's content, you know, whereas in Alaska, I feel like it feels a lot more free to us, I guess. So that has kept us here.
That's a great point. Yeah. I was just listening, John Gearock, we got him coming back on the podcast I guess it's probably in a couple months, but you know, he was talking on another thing he did about, you know, private property, right. And stuff like that.
Yeah.
And especially up in Colorado, you know, you definitely, or anywhere in the lower 48, I mean, there's private property, but in Alaska, do you feel like, I mean, I guess there's not a lot of private property. It's kind of all mostly public lands. Is that how it looks out there?
It is. Yeah. It's interesting. Cause I mean, for one thing, we have the navigable stream law. So if you get in the water and as long as you're below the high water mark, you can basically hike up and down river as far as you want to. And then as far as, you know, actual land goes, yeah, it's huge swaths of state land or borough land. They're called boroughs up here. They're not counties. What can make that tricky though is if a place is not part of a borough, then their private land listings aren't posted. So it could be private land and you would have no idea. So you just have to be a little, more cognizant of that, I guess. But yeah, for the most part, big giant swaths of state land where you could just hike for days if you want to, and don't have to worry about, you know, stepping on anyone's toes in that regard. So
that's it. So that's what it is, the freedom. And then, and what it would it take? I mean, you've been up there a while, but if somebody was thinking about, you know, tapping their foot in the water to see what Alaska would be like, you know, living up there. Is that pretty easy? Like if somebody wanted to move up there for a year or two and see what that's like, what would you recommend there?
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, Fairbanks, Anchorage, kind of the population hubs, that's where I ended up, you know, and
yeah.
I found that for the most part, of course, there are exceptions, but for the most part, outdoorsmen up here, you know, anglers, they're fairly welcoming of newcomers. Like they're always happy to, you know, get you started. They may not share like their honey holes right off the bat. But they're always happy to, you know, show you the ropes and get you going. So, yeah. And of course, like documentation of the good streams up here is pretty easy to find. I mean, there are several books on the subject, just Googling around. And then, like I said, yeah, people are pretty welcoming for the most part.
Yeah. Pretty easy to get going.
Yeah.
And how long have you been up there now?
8 years. I came up in 2014. Yeah.
2014. So what have you seen? Have you, you know, over the last 8 years, have you seen a lot of changes? I mean, you hear about changes in like declines and Chinook numbers, but just general in Alaska, have you seen in 8 years, a lot of changes?
I would say so. I mean, I may not be the best person to ask on that, Dave, just because like my goal when I'm fishing is to get away from people. So I'm getting up at like 1 or 2 AM in the summertime and in the fall just to get to the stream first and hike as far as I can. So I don't have the best gauge on, you know, if numbers of other anglers have increased.
Yeah.
But yeah, certainly things like evidence of fishing, you know, a lot of the streams that I fish that I feel like used to be pristine, you know, you'll unfortunately come across more instances of litter. You'll find trout with, you know, broken jaws or scarred up mouths just from, you know, barbed hooks or whatever the case is, maybe bad hookup. See more evidence of that. And then, like you mentioned, the declining Chinook runs are a bummer. But I'm kind of new to that whole game. So I've seen changes like the last 3-4 years, but in terms of the whole 8 years that I've been here, it really started, 4 years ago.
4 years ago. Okay, yeah. Cool. Well, today I want to dig into, you've got some books out there and you're, you know, you're a writer. So you've done a lot of writing on Alaska and you've got an article in Fly Fisherman magazine. I wanted to dig into the road system. You know, yeah. We talked about this on a recent episode with Will a little bit. We focus more on the area around Anchorage and kind of up to, you know, the Susitna sort of thing. But maybe you could break down, you know, just the road. Because when I think of Alaska road system, I think, you know, I've driven up the Alaska Highway and, you know, you could drive all the way up there and you hit Anchorage and then you can head up to Fairbanks and probably go further north. But I mean, is that the road? Is it pretty much that the one? Or what would you, when somebody asks like, okay, I'm doing a trip to Alaska on the road system. I've got, you know, whatever, maybe a summer even to just travel. You know, what do you tell somebody? Do you have a good step-by-step or is there a lot to know to learn on it?
I wouldn't say there's a lot to know. I guess figure out what species you want to prioritize would be a good one because, you know, certain species are available in different places. I guess the helpful side of me would say, you know, Parks Highway is a great place to start. And that's the road you mentioned, like Anchorage to Fairbanks, probably the most popular road in the state, just because it's, you know, connecting those two population hubs. And also it goes through Denali National Park. So well-traveled, well-documented, and it just so happens to intersect, you know, a dozen or more really good trout streams, like world-class trout fishing based on what I've experienced. So I'd say that's a good starting point. You know, if you fly into Anchorage, as most people do, rent a car. That's the other nice thing about the parks. It's you could take a rental car on it. Some roads up here, rental cars prohibit you from driving them on. So Parks Highway is a great place to start. The more honest side of me would say go to the interior. I know a lot of anglers have like Arctic grayling on their bucket list, and that's kind of one of my favorite species. You're not going to catch a 2 or 3 foot long trout in the interior. So,
and what is the interior? What does the interior include? Yeah. What area is that?
Good question. So that's anything north of the Alaska Range, so the range that Denali is a part of, and then basically anything south of the Brooks Range. So like the Fairbanks area, the Yukon and Tanana River, those watersheds, that's Alaska's interior.
Okay.
So yeah, if you're looking for the giant trout, that's not where you're going to want to go. But if you're looking for more of the secluded small stream experience with the opportunity to catch world-class grayling, that'd be the place to go. And I've always thought of that region as kind of like the purest fly fisherman's place, because it's like all dry fly fishing. I mean, you can fish nymphs and actually it's super fun to fish grayling on the swing. I've discovered, but dry flies are the name of the game up there. And it's pretty fun when you have fish that are willing to party on the surface, you know, and you can just go up or down as far as you want. So,
right. How do you think it compares to, you know, we've done some trips out there to remote Alaska. You know, a lot of people know Alaska, you know, fly out. It's like everybody's got an airplane, right, to get out there. But how do you think the, you know, compares like this road system fishing, all this stuff versus say flying out to a remote part of over there on out of Bethel on the, you know what I mean, like Connectok or anywhere in Alaska that's remote, or, you know, that's a fly in. What do you think the comparison's like there?
I think for the most part, you know, you're not going to encounter as, I don't know, fast and furious fishing on the road system as you might in a fly out. You certainly might not get the size fish just because, you know, they're probably eating a little bit better and they're not hit as hard, I guess is a better way to put it. But to be honest, I've never taken a fly out trip. I'm kind of a road system dirt bagger at this point. But from stories I've heard from others that have done fly outs, you know, some of the streams I fish, it's like, I feel like I do just as well, if not better than their reports. So, I'm fairly confident in that, but that may be the quality of the fishery. That might be, you know, just me trying to go farther than other road system anglers are, to where I get to that more remote sense of fishing, I guess. So,
yeah, right. You can get out away from it. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, if you were going to fly out, where you would go first in Alaska? Because there's so many places, right? I mean,
that's a good question, Dave. I'd probably say Arctic Alaska. you can drive up there. There's the Dalton Highway. That's one of the places where you have to get a specialized rental car company because most of them won't let you take a car up there. But my wife and I took a trip up there a couple of Septembers ago trying to hit the Sea Run Dolly Varden when they're coming up to spawn, because those fish are just incredible. I mean, they're gorgeous and they can get huge coming out of the Arctic Ocean. And you can target them on the road system, but I'd really like to do a fly out, get a pack raft, maybe drive up there to one of those remote airstrips, do a fly out to, you know, one of the many tributaries to those big Arctic rivers and just float back to the road and drive home. I think that'd be a super fun trip.
That'd be pretty cool. What does the species list look like? You mentioned Arctic grayling, you know, on the road system. Is it pretty much everything? You can catch everything? What's that look like?
I'd say, yeah, you can catch just about anything. I mean, you got all five species of Pacific salmon, you know, at various points along the road system. You've got pretty good steelhead fishing down on like the Sterling Highway. Rainbow trout, of course, Alaska rainbows, Arctic grayling, pike. You can get pike on the road system. It might take a little bit of hiking, but you can get it at some good pike fishing. Dolly Varden, of course, some Arctic char. But yeah, I feel like any species, Alaskan species you want to, if you try hard enough, you can locate some on the road system. So
you can find them. Nice. Yeah. Well, let's just think of somebody who's trying to plan a trip, right? And maybe they're even driving up, maybe they're down in Canada or on the West Coast and they're just going to drive up.
Yeah.
What would you recommend as far as timing? Because there's probably, I don't know, you know, busy times maybe, but when would be a really good time if you want to kind of hit some fish and travel and have a good experience?
Yeah. I'd say, you know, think about what species again you want to prioritize, because that's going to influence, you know, when you should.
Let's say if it was, you know, let's throw a few like Arctic grayling, you know, maybe throw some rainbows. I'm not sure if there's some mousing in there. Let's just say that you want to hit some rainbows with some mice, some Arctic grayling, and maybe even Chinook, but that would be like your third one, like maybe for at the end of the trip.
Okay. Yeah. So all signs point to June at that point. I would say, so yeah, like say like third week of June, you're coming up. Yeah. I mean, grayling, the nice thing about them is they're basically available all summer long. They overwinter in the larger rivers, and then they'll trickle up into their headwater streams during the summertime. So by that time in June, they're going to be in the small streams where they're going to spend the summer. So, you could pick those up, and I mean, dry flies, nymphs, they're eating pretty heavily at that point. You might be able to catch, speaking of trout, of course you can through mouse patterns, and that's a super fun way to fish trout up here, just because they're hungry, they're voracious. And then also there, you might catch the tail end of the smolt run, which is when the out migrating salmon smolt, you know, the little 1 to 2 year old fingerlings, they're swimming back, headed toward the ocean eventually. Typically that happens like late May, early June on the road system. But like I said, you might be able to catch the tail end of that, or at least fool a couple of nice trout into some smolt patterns, you know?
Right. That's cool.
Yeah. So then in that case, again, like Parks Highway is going to be your place to go for the trout. And assuming you're coming up from the Alaska Highway, that actually would make for a pretty nice and easy trip, because you could hit the interior on your way down, because the Alaska Highway would take you straight into Delta Junction. And then you could take the Richardson down, fish grayling on the way down to Anchorage, and then pop up the Parks Highway and fish trout.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then getting into Kings, kind of our last criteria here. Kenai Peninsula is kind of where it's at for Kings at that point. You can catch Kings on the Parks Highway, but those fisheries have closed down, unfortunately. Oh. In recent years, you know, they've Alaska Department of Fish and Game has issued emergency closures just because the runs have been so low. But then Kenai Peninsula, I mean, they do the same thing. They'll close runs occasionally, but there are a few rivers down there that tend to stay open a little bit longer. They have bigger runs, I think, on average, so they tend to stay open a little longer.
Gotcha. Okay. So and let's just take it, let's just take Chinook out of the equation and just say you want to experience the highway in Alaska or the road system, and catch fish wherever you end up. What would be the best time if you're not really thinking specifically for a species?
If you can swing the shoulder season, I'd say like late August, early September. For a few reasons. I mean, one, the fish know that winter's coming and it's time to start putting the boogie on for eating. And then also salmon have been dropping eggs, at least like the kings and the sockeyes. They've been dropping eggs for a while. You've got pinks and chums coming in if it's a pink year, which is every other year, so even numbered years. We just had a pink year this summer, and it'll be kind of a lower year this coming summer. But basically everything's dropping eggs. I mean, there's decaying salmon carcasses in the river, so fish are fat and happy. They're willing to eat, so that's always fun. And of course, like, beads are the main game at that time, like egg imitations, flesh flies. But you can also still catch a lot of really nice fish. Sometimes the biggest fish in a hole will move better for a swung streamer than they will for an egg, just because on the road system, you know, they've seen a million egg patterns, you know, you know, poorly presented egg and flesh imitations. So if you can throw a swung fly in front of them, oftentimes they're pretty aggressive for that.
Okay. And so that would be good late August, early September. As you come up to, maybe just describe the road system. So you've talked about a little bit the main arteries. You know, are there places, like if you had your own car and you were just kind of going to be like, I want to take this spur road out, how would you find all those roads and like where maybe you might not want to go because it might get a little sketchy? Is there any advice there?
Yeah. There are a few roads like that. Spur roads are kind of hard because they're not always well documented, like on the internet. It's kind of like you have to be there to know what's there. On the Parks Highway, there's the Petersville Spur Road, which that can lead to some pretty good fishing. But it can also get pretty potholy, pretty sketchy, especially during moose season, which starts up tail end of August most years. But then trying to think here, you can go up. I mean, for trout, really, the Parks Highway is pretty special just because it literally crosses over so many good trout streams. You don't have to go down any spur roads to find it. I mean, there are little like gravel roads that, you know, skirt the river for however far, but that's not something a rental car company is going to have a problem you taking it down. But
yeah,
assuming you have your own car and you're like, say, in the interior, there's like the Taylor Highway, there's the Steis Highway, there's the Manly Hot Springs Highway. All of those lead to good grayling fishing, and they can get sketchy because they're gravel, they're all gravel in some places, and pretty frost heavy. We have these big frost heaves up here that make for some pretty interesting car rides sometimes. But
Is that time of year, that August, is that as far as weather, is that pretty much, I mean, is it pretty much like July, August, September are all just perfect for weather? It's light all day long and great.
It starts getting dark August and September, and I mentioned earlier, you know, like my wake up call during that season is like 1 or 2 a.m. just to make sure that I'm on the water before the sun comes up. And that might happen at like 4 or 5 in late August. And then it starts getting, you know, darker and darker as, you know, you hear about Alaska, the dark, right? That starts to take over in September. But weather-wise, August can be rainy, which that can be a good thing sometimes, you know, bring water levels up and get more food moving through the system. What's unfortunate is it can easily turn into, I don't know, like Alaska's monsoon season. For example, this past summer, like July 15th, it started raining.
Yeah, it hammered.
We got hammered.
Didn't stop.
Yeah, it started raining basically till October when things started freezing. So,
God, that's right. Yeah, we were up there with Fish Hound Expeditions.
Okay.
And we flew into like the Susitna, some tribs up there. And yeah, it was just super high.
Yeah,
and, it turned out it started dropping for us a little bit, but yeah, they said, I think Adam said they had like 5 huge flooding events in one summer.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. I mean, I've seen some pretty big rain years in the 8 years I've been here, but last fall was the biggest by far.
And that was the biggest.
Yeah, a lot of the streams that I do super well on for trout in the fall, I couldn't fish because, you know, you're hiking down, you're like crossing over a dozen times in the course of a day, and you just can't cross safely. So, which was a huge bummer because, you know, it was a pink year. There was a lot of food in the river. The few trout that I did catch were just, you know, fat and super aggressive. And I wish I had been able to fish, you know, the whole system.
Today's episode is sponsored by Country Financial. The fires in the Northwest and throughout the West in the last few years have been devastating for thousands of people. Some folks have lost their homes, their belongings, and their sense of safety has all been challenged. This is why insurance and protecting your assets are so critical. Dalton at Country Financial is here, and he was on the front lines during the fires, handing out checks to Country Financial community members, providing drinks, food, and more. And each time Dalton meets up with a client, he does an extensive review of their current assets and coverage. This is his opportunity to really decide and let you know what you need to make educated decisions for your insurance needs. This is a super critical piece, and Dalton Roy loves it. He loves getting out in the rural community, connecting with people, loves the outdoors, fishing, hunting, everything that goes with it. And so I'm excited to be sharing Country Financial and Dalton with you. The unexpected will happen, so it's always best to make sure your assets and life are protected. You can head over to wetflyswing.com/country right now to get started. That's C-O-U-N-T-R-Y. Check out Dalton and support this podcast and a great local company right now. Well, I'm looking at a map here that's on, I guess this is like alaskateacher.org. It's got, it's got like the road system and numbered letters for each one. And I was just going to look at a few of these here. I mean, you got the main one from Fairbanks up north is the Dalton Highway you mentioned.
Yeah.
You got out of Fairbanks there, let's see, the Stiesse Highway?
Stiesse Highway, yep.
Goes out to Circle. Is that something, what's that like? You're kind of up north there. Is that a pretty cool area?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think it's pretty cool. It gets pretty busy with caribou hunters in August and September, because that's one of the, I mean, you got the big city of, well, relatively speaking, the big city of Fairbanks, and, you know, 50,000 people would love to go out and shoot a caribou within 50 miles of their front door. So,
oh, right. So everybody's out there.
Everybody's going for it. Of course, grayling would be the name of the game if you were going on the Stiesse.
Okay.
Which, that said, you can easily get away from caribou hunters, because I mean they're not following the creeks the same way you would be. So,
oh, right, it'd be different.
Yeah, and for upland hunters too. I mean, that's something I've gotten more into. The Stiesse Highway can be awesome for ptarmigan hunting, but they're fighting caribou hunters for, you know, camping spots or whatever the case is. So,
okay,
pretty neat road though.
Yeah. What about if you on Fairbanks, if you head like out towards Canada, this is on the, yeah, I guess that's towards Haines Junction. I guess that is the Alaska Highway. That's how you come in.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There are a lot of good grayling streams there. You can take a little strategizing, but you can take boats like across the Tanana River and do hike-ins for some pretty epic pike fly fishing. Mm-hmm. In around like the Delta area, but then right around Delta is some of the best grayling fishing, I think, in the state. I mean, there's the Delta Clearwater River, which that's such an amazing fishery. It's got everything that grayling need to get big, and it's just, yeah, I don't know. I always compare it. It's like Alaska's version of the Henry Fork. Mm-hmm. You know, just dry fly fishing, reliable hatches. It's a pretty cool place.
Nice. Okay. So, and I'm just trying to get a feel for, I mean, it seems like, yeah, you got the main roads and there's a lot of the side stuff, you'd have to kind of do a little more research on it.
For sure.
And maybe even timing, if you wanted to hit more of that, you know, summertime, longer days, probably July. What's July look like in Alaska if you're doing the road system?
Yeah, July's pretty great. I mean, typically you could have a shot at all five Pacific salmon species if you want to, depending on where you are. And weather-wise, I'd say July is probably the most reliable. In fact, when my parents come up to visit, I always suggest, you know, July or early August, just because weather's most reliable. To miss the rain. Of course, this past summer was the exception to that rule. The other thing about July to consider, though, is it's also typically the busiest time. So if you're interested in getting away from people, it can be done, but just be aware that, you know, as many people as are going to come to Alaska to fish are probably going to do it in July or thereabouts.
Right. That's July. Yeah. And then June, you could get a little fewer people if you hit June, but then what's the problem with June versus July?
Yeah, problem with June is depending on snowfall, the winter before, you can still be experiencing some pretty heavy rivers, heavy murky rivers, just from snowmelt and, you know, ice thawing up in the mountains from headwater streams. That's always the danger. You know, that can happen last week of May. It can happen like middle of May, but it can also happen third week of June too. It all just depends on snowpack and what the winter was like and what the spring's like too. If temperatures stay low and stuff doesn't thaw for a while, then you're kind of out of luck.
Gotcha. So basically you got July, which is the peak. You got August, which could be great, but it could also rain on you.
Yeah.
And then you got September, which could be great too, and likely good weather, but then it's getting a little darker out. But yeah, I see why September could be the one. And then you get into like October. And I mean, at what point do you get where you don't want to be driving up, you know, up and around Alaska too much?
Yeah, I'd say probably mid-October is pretty safe. I mean, that said, there are always exceptions, right? Like, I think it was a couple of years ago, it wasn't until the second week in November that we had a good snowfall that stuck, you know, in which case you could fish. But the other thing too, like trout, I'll use them as an example here. Mm-hmm. I mean, grayling too, but they know when to head back to the main river, you know. They're coming up into their little streams for the summer to feed, but then they're dropping back down. So usually past mid-October, it's harder to catch them because they're using the Susitna for an example. They're back in the Susitna, and that's a big, fairly murky river.
Yeah.
I have heard of guys that have timed it, you know, exactly right, like third week of October, and they're fishing the Susitna when it's cleared up, like ice is locking up high and the river is cleared for a few days before it freezes. Yeah.
Wow.
But that's a pretty specific situation that someone traveling up here, it'd be next to impossible to time that correctly, you know?
Yeah.
Tough. Overall, like, yeah, mid-October is probably the
best.
The end of it. Yeah.
What are some of the, I want to get into some of your books too, and some of the articles you've written here in a sec, but what are some of the other sites? You know, you've got Denali, which is cool. I mean, if somebody was coming up doing like the family trip, definitely wanted to do lots of fishing, but also wanted to just experience Alaska. What would you tell somebody? What would they think about researching?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And one that I'm getting better at answering. In the past, it was always like fishing for me.
Yeah.
If it didn't involve fishing, I wasn't interested. So like, the sites off to the side, you know, the tourist things to do, I didn't really experience, but I'm getting better about that. So, I would say like the Delta Junction area is just beautiful to be in. And in fact, that stretch of road from Delta down to like Paxson, this is the Richardson Highway, that goes through the Alaska Range, that's got to be one of the prettiest drives in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And there are a lot of pretty neat hiking trails along that route. In fact, one of them you can hike like right up to a glacier. I believe it's the Kastner Glacier Trail. But yeah, plenty of opportunities. It's a fairly long drive, but a lot of opportunities to stop, take the family out, you know, take the dog out if you have one, and walk around. So.
That's out of like Richardson Highway ends at Valdez, is that right?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, so Valdez up to what is the next junction up there? Glen Allen.
Glen Allen, yeah. And actually, that's where my wife's family is near Glen Allen. So we spend a lot of time in what's considered the Copper River Valley, right around there. That's a pretty amazing area to be in too. A lot of a lot of local history. There's the town of McCarthy, which that might be another spur road that rental car companies don't like you going on, but
yeah. How do those rental companies, how do they know, what roads you're on?
That's a good question. I think a lot of them have trackers in them.
Oh, they have trackers in them. Right. They got smart.
I think so.
Yeah.
Cause they have, right. Yeah, my wife's aunt and uncle and their family came up a few years ago and they didn't know that you couldn't take a rental car on the Denali Highway. And they did. And I believe they got charged for it fairly significantly.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are rental companies that do let you, you know, it's like 4x4 rentals. I think Alaska 4x4 and Alaska Overlander are a few companies that they don't mind you taking their vehicles out just because they're equipped for that, you know?
Yep.
But yeah, and then as far as other attractions go, I mentioned like McCarthy and the Kennecott Copper Mine. That's pretty cool. Valdez is pretty fun to visit. I mean, if you want to take a break from the fly fishing and do some halibut fishing, some saltwater stuff, that's a great place to do it. And then also the Kenai Peninsula, if you're headed down that way, which it's pretty close to Anchorage. So if you're flying into Anchorage, for example, that's a super easy trip to take is down to the Kenai. Yeah. I mean, not only is the Kenai River world famous as far as fishing goes, right? Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of hiking trails that take you like straight up into the mountains within the Chugach National Forest down there. So that's pretty awesome. And then, of course, you've got Seward and Homer.
Yeah,
both coastal towns that are pretty awesome to experience too.
Good stuff. And you got the national park, the fjords, right? Fjords or whatever it is down there, Kenai Fjords. Yeah.
Take a boat trip, see some whales. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that would be cool. And what is the, I'm guessing camping, you know, there's lots of that. Is it pretty much you can kind of camp? How does that look? Could you just pull off and find a cool spot and camp, you know, wherever there's, you know what I mean? Like, or do you have, is it kind of designated stuff?
Yeah, you can. I mean, there are definitely designated, like manicured bells and whistles campgrounds that you can stay in. But yeah, you can pull off the side of the road and camp if you want to. I mean, make sure it's a safe area and you're not like on private property, right? But
yeah,
that's another thing that, you know, going back to your question about why I've stayed up here, and I mentioned the freedom thing, like just being able to, you know, camp wherever is pretty freeing.
Yeah.
So especially with, you know, the way I fish and tend to do things, like getting up super early, like I rarely set up a tent. I'm usually just sleeping in the bed of my truck, like not comfortable at all, but it does the job and I don't have to take the time to set up camp. So
sure.
And then I can just pull off and sleep, get up and go fish. So
right. That's perfect. What's Anchorage? You know, you've lived in both places, Fairbanks versus Anchorage. You know, what's the difference between those two?
So, I mean, Anchorage is a lot bigger. Obviously, it's, you know, it's coastal, whereas Fairbanks is interior. So weather, like Fairbanks gets so much colder than Anchorage.
Oh, it does,
Yeah. But then, I don't know, everyone in Alaska that, you know, they love to hate on Anchorage.
That's right.
It's like Lost Anchorage, or the other joke is,
oh yeah,
if you're in Anchorage, you can almost see Alaska.
That's right.
So, but it's a hub, right? It's nice to have
that's where everybody is. I mean, what is it? 80-90% of the people are in Anchorage.
Exactly. Yeah. Or the Mat-Su Valley, which is, you know, right next door. So.
Have you guys thought about, you know, where could you go outside of Anchorage and Fairbanks that could be a cool, you know, are there places, or does it just get kind of tougher to live out there?
It does get tougher to live. And that's something my wife and I have talked a lot about, just coming from rural backgrounds, like being in a city, it just, you know, we never have felt totally comfortable in a city. And so we've talked about, you know, where would we move? And I've always mentioned like Delta Junction, like that'd be a cool place. It's got, you know, a pretty nice community feel, and it's also, you know, the biggest farming area in Alaska. So there's that type of community. But, you know, with any small town, like there are issues, like think about raising kids, like if they're in a bad bunch of kids, like nowhere to go, schools, exactly. Like trying to get groceries, that's harder, more expensive, like everything's just more challenging.
Right.
And then we've talked about Glen Allen too, like where she grew up, and kind of same issues there.
What's that like? What's Glen Ellen like? How is it like populated? Is it just super tiny?
It's fairly tiny. I think it's got, I don't know, 3,000-4,000 people, you know, in the larger area. And so it's got like a grocery store. It's got like a bank. It's got like a lot of the major facilities that you need. Yeah.
Town.
But like her parents, they still come into to Anchorage mostly for groceries.
Oh, wow.
So that's like,
how far is it from Anchorage to Glen Ellen?
It's about 3.5 hours, probably closer to 4 in the winter. So you're making a pretty good haul just for grocery runs, you know?
Yeah, that's right. That's it. I mean, everything is, yeah. I mean, everything's hub, you know, around Anchorage, around, I mean, when you look at the, I'm just looking at this one map, but I mean, yeah, everything is around Anchorage and Fairbanks. And then if pretty much the whole, you know, western part of the state, there's not a single road. It doesn't look like there's a single road, you know, kind
yeah.
of west. Is that true? Or are there roads tucked in there somewhere?
I mean, there are little gravel roads tucked in there, like ATV, snow machine trails, things that can pass for roads if you try hard enough, I suppose. There is a small highway system up by Nome.
Oh, I see that. Yeah, a little. Yeah, so you could fly in there and then drive
yeah.
a little bit.
Actually, yeah, that's a trip I'm kind of intrigued by, is just flying into Nome and, you know, renting a little car and driving around, because
looks cool.
Yeah, that Seward Peninsula, which that's kind of a common misconception. People hear the town Seward and then you see the landform Seward Peninsula. You think they're in the same spot.
Oh,
they're like
no.
opposite parts of the state.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, when you look at a map, and I've been up to Bethel, I've been up to Fairbanks, but you know, I didn't realize, I always thought, you know, think of Bethel as like way up north, but really that whole Kuskokwim, all that stuff is pretty far south. I mean, Fairbanks
yeah.
is at the same, you know, cross from Nome, but yeah. So Fairbanks is way up there. I mean, what happens when you go up towards north on the Dalton Highway? What is that Dalton Highway? Have you driven that up there?
I have. It's pretty cool. I mean, it's a road that your trip can, nothing can go wrong. It can be a super pleasant trip, and it can be one where everything goes wrong. You know, everyone says to plan on bringing like 2 extra full size spare tires, like 10 to 20 extra gallons of gas,
right.
tire compressor, basically a totally robust emergency kit, because
right. there aren't gas stations everywhere up there.
Right. There's a gas station, of course, like leaving Fairbanks, you've got access to gas, but then it's not until you get to Coldfoot, which I don't know off the top of my head how far Coldfoot is from Anchorage, but it's a solid 4 or 5 hour drive, you know?
Yeah.
And then Coldfoot to Dead Horse, I think is like 240 miles, and Dead Horse would be, you know, that's way up against the Arctic Ocean. That'd be the next spot to get gas or automotive help if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got these huge stretches where there's just nothing. I mean, and the kind of the saving grace there is that the Dalton's pretty well traveled by truckers just going up to the oil fields there in Dead Horse.
Issue.
So, and they're always, you know, willing to lend a helping hand. And,
yeah,
and there are a few DOT stations, which that's kind of what saved our bacon a few years ago.
Oh, you had some problems?
We had, yeah, popped 2 tires up there.
On, and what are you popping the tires on? How are the tires getting popped?
Just the gravel. It's funny, the truckers call the Dalton gravel arrowheads.
Huh.
Because yeah, just pop tires are such a common thing up there. And of course, in my naivety, I just brought one full size spare and never thought I'd pop 2 within like an hour of each other.
Wow.
And so luckily we had tire plugs, but we didn't have a portable tire compressor, so we swung into one of the DOT stations, and luckily they were nice enough to help us out. We gave them some cookies in exchange, I think. But
yeah.
Jeez.
So you were, so that is the thing. So the tires is the big thing, and then gas.
And gas,
And it's just, but that highway is worth the trip, because what you're seeing, you know, how is it different than say if you're driving down from Fairbanks, kind of south or towards Haines Junction?
Yeah. I mean, it's just wilder. It's more rugged. I mean, you can drive up there and, I mean, we saw muskox when we drove up there. Like,
that's not
an animal that many people get to see, you know? So it's pretty cool to do that.
And it's gravel.
It's gravel. Yep.
Yep. So you're cruising like 40, 50 miles an hour the whole way.
Yep. Yeah. I think 45 is kind of the general speed you're going. But yeah, I mean, just seeing things you wouldn't see anywhere else. And of course, far fewer people. I mean, you have a few adventurers that will be traveling the road with you, but, yeah, it's a pretty solitary experience, which is cool.
That is cool. Well, let's hear about your let's hear about some of your books. Give us a rundown on what you've written, and also on the I want to talk about that fly fisherman. Any articles that maybe we can highlight, put a link to that would share, you know, more insight onto this road system.
Sure. So I mentioned I just kind of finished up writing one for Fly Fisherman magazine. Of course, I've learned to never bank on an article showing up until it's like published and in my hand, you know, because I know in the publishing industry, magazines, books, whatever, like things change, things happen. So, I mean, they happen slowly, but they can also happen quickly. So, fingers crossed that one actually shows up. But that was all about the road system. So kind of everything we just discussed, you know, in written form is basically what that one is. And then, my book, my first book just came out on Tuesday, actually. It's called It's Only Fishing. And it was about my 2020 season, of course, the pandemic year, and being a road system angler. That's basically a memoir of a year in the life of a road system angler up here. So,
oh, perfect.
That provides some information. It's mostly, you know, some insights, hopefully some experiences in fly fishing that others can relate to. And
so that'd be a good one to, if you're traveling up there, that'd be a good one to throw in the glove box to read on your way up.
Yeah. I mean, if anything, it might inspire you to, you know, see what's around the next bend or hike that extra mile, just, you know, see what's out there. That's kind of the tack I tried to take with it. I told myself at the beginning of the season, I was going to write an essay for every fishing trip I took, whether it was successful or not, you know? And so the book is sort of a combination of all of them. A lot of them got edited out just because they didn't turn out very well, but, the rest I'm pretty happy with. So I hope people buy it and enjoy it.
How many out of that book, how many essays did you have total? And then how many made it into the book?
I think I wrote something like 20 and then 16 of them made it into the book. So
yeah, so just four got cut out of there. So these are your travels through 2020, like basically starting in what May and through into October.
Yeah, exactly. So then it's also kind of a seasonal study, I guess, of Alaska, you know, what you can expect in different seasons. Like May is ice out fishing, which can be hit or miss. And then we kind of finish out with October, which can also be hit or miss. In fact, I think the last chapter, it's about duck hunting more than it is fishing because the fish weren't around. So I ended up hunting ducks instead.
Nice. There you go. Well, maybe we'll touch on the duck hunting. What was in that 2020 in the book? Was there an event or a crazy thing that happened to you during that whole thing? What was the weirdest, craziest thing that you remember? Was it pretty straightforward?
There were a few things. I don't know. I guess one of my selling points for the book is that it's like unexceptional adventures of a road system angler, which I think a lot of fly anglers can, you know, relate to, because, you know, when you go fishing, most of the time it's fairly uneventful. Like, yeah, you might catch the fish of a lifetime. You might do okay. But, so that's kind of why I wrote it. I just thought that people could identify with those types of stories more than the typical adventure. Like I got chased down by a bear, you know, that sort of thing.
Did you catch a fish of a lifetime during that book?
I caught a couple that, They were close to my biggest trout, but they were pretty memorable fish. Just because 2020, that was a pink year, so the fishing was pretty outstanding. But in terms of fish of a lifetime, they were just super tough fish. You know, they'd seen beads thrown at them, you know, for a month. They were ones that didn't go for my swung fly strategy, and so I really had to sit and think about them and think how I was going to catch those fish, and ended up catching them luckily, so a happy ending there. But yeah, in terms of the challenge, I think is what made them the fish of a lifetime. And then talking about weird experiences, that same chapter, which I think it's either chapter 13 or chapter 14, it's called Pops. It's about my grandpa, but anyway, that same trip, I came across four grizzly bears at once in the creek I was fishing. And
wow,
luckily it wasn't, you know, they were like 20 feet from me or something. I came around the bend. I saw this pink salmon flopping around, you know, her head torn open freshly, because bears love eating salmon brains for whatever reason.
That's right.
And I thought, I'm about to see a bear, you know, and I come around the gravel bar, and sure enough, there's there's three, they must have been yearlings, but there were three yearling grizzlies fishing like one of the best trout pools on the stream, because it's of course stacked with salmon. And I'm like 100 yards away with bear spray. I didn't carry a pistol back then. I do now. I yelled at them. And luckily these bears, this was like Northern Parks Highway area. So they're still fairly wild bears. They're not accustomed to, you know, people and the whole fishing game like they are maybe down on like the Russian or the Kenai River. And so I shouted at them. It got their attention. They started moving off. But then it must have been the mom that had adopted either one or two of the cubs. I'm not sure. But she came out and she was, you know, full-size grizzly bear. She's what you think of when you think of grizzly bear. And I yelled at her and she just stood up at me, and I'm looking at this like 7-foot bear and I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna stand here, you do what you need to do, when you're gone I'll move along, you know. Luckily they eventually sauntered off and didn't see him again. But
you never thought you were gonna die at any point on that one.
No, but I'm sure you've seen bears, Dave. Like,
yeah,
just being in their presence, regardless of the distance, like,
yeah, you know, they could take you down.
Yeah, it's an awesome experience, but it's also like primal fear, you know, that right. You feel like at the base of your spine sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Today's episode is sponsored by Maverick Fly Fishing. They make the lightest Euro Nymph reel in the world, which makes your rod more sensitive, casting more accurate, and you can hold your dead drifts longer without the shoulder burn. This reel is so unique, you may not even recognize it as a fly reel. I had a chance to fish the Stinger reel with Jeff on his home river on the Truckee. The biggest thing that I remember is the weight. The weight really stuck out because you can't even barely tell there's a reel. It's essentially kind of like you're holding a rod all day long. I mean, it's that light, and when you're Euro nymphing, that is a key. And the other big thing I remember from that day was catching a fish on my first cast. Pretty cool to be down in that part of the country and have some great success with Jeff. Maverick keeps things simple by offering a Euro nymph product line with essentials you'll need from rod, reel, fly line, and leader system. Euro nymphing doesn't have to be complicated, so let Maverick Fly Fishing get you started right now. You can learn more by checking out Maverick's YouTube channel for some tips and tutorials. And you can also head over right now to wetflyswing.com/Maverick to check out the good stuff they have going. That's Maverick, M-A-V-R-K, wetflyswing.com/Maverick to support this podcast and take a look at one of the most unique and efficient Euro nymphing setups on the market. Okay, back to the show. Okay, and what about on your, so your writing, so you've written this book, you've written some other stuff on that Fly Fisherman article, maybe describe that a little bit. Was that, does that take what we talked about today on the road system a little further, or is it kind of what we talked about?
It does, yeah. So it goes over basically all the roads we talked about, the species, the timing, but then it gets into flies and what you can expect as far as tactics go, and then just kind of general considerations. With my writing, I always try and take more of a why to approach instead of how to. I mean, not only is that kind of where fly fishing literature is going in general, which I really like, you know, magazines like Strung and Gray Sporting Journal and mm-hmm. Fly Fish Journal and the Drake, it's more like the culture of the sport instead of just how to do it.
Yeah.
And so even in more how to magazines, I try and make it more why to and how to appreciate where you're fishing and the fish you're catching. Mm-hmm. So it's not like tie on this length of, you know, 3X tippet, tie it to this size fly. It's not quite that detailed in terms of how to, but I feel like I definitely give some guidelines on where to start. So
where to start, what is on your writing, you know, who I mentioned John Gearock, who obviously has written some good stuff. Who were some of your influencers in the writing space?
Yeah, definitely John Gearock. In fact, one of my favorite quotes of his graces the front of my book, and I was very honored when he agreed to let me do that. And that one is, you could say the same thing about fishing that they say about baseball, that it takes an adult to play the game well, but it takes a kid to think it's important.
That's right. That's a great one.
That is a great one. Yeah. John Gearock, definitely. I feel like I emulated his style probably mostly in my writing, just because I love his, you know, conversational style. I mean, it feels like he's just telling you a fishing story over a beer or a campfire or something.
Yeah.
But I also definitely like Thomas McGuane, you know, Ted Leeson, Harry Middleton, those famous fly fishing writers. So, and kind of the deeper conversations that they get into, you know, using fishing as sort of the lens through which to view those deeper things.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's not the fishing. It's the stories within.
Exactly. Yeah.
Getting to the fishing or all that. And that's kind of what you do in your book. You've got the fishing there, which is, you know, you're picking up the book maybe for that, but you go into other stuff. What is the most random in that book, the most random topic or story you went into that's not even related to fishing?
That's a good question. Probably, I don't know, just my experience in becoming a teacher is kind of apparent in the book. Because at the time, I mean, not only was everyone thrown into the whirlwind of COVID-19 during the summer of 2020, but it was also a pretty strange year for me, because I gave up a salaried job producing videos for the university so I could start my teaching internship to be a high school teacher. And so I was between jobs, and teaching internships, they're not paid up here. So that was a pretty big consideration. You could just say I had a lot on my mind during that summer. And so some of the conversations are just kind of that angst of young adulthood, and, you know, am I going to be able to pay for this tire I just popped? And like,
right. Yeah.
60% of my monthly budget's going to gas just to get around and fish and write about it. Like, is this really the most responsible choice I could be making? But ultimately I found like 2020 was really just the perfect excuse to go fishing a lot and, you know, this book came out of it. So I think that gas money was worth it.
That was good. What was for Gearock? I'm going to have him mention he's coming back on. Do you have a question you would ask him if you had him in front of you and you were talking to him?
Ooh, that's a good one. You put me on the spot, Dave.
Yeah. Well, think about if you don't have one right away, we will bring you back at the 2 minute drill at the end. We'll circle back around on that if you come up with something, but
I guess I do have one.
Yeah. Let's hear it.
Yeah. So I guess what does he feel is his like crowning achievement as a writer? Is it like, you know, writing a bestseller, or is it hearing from readers that what he wrote really resonated with him? Like, what does he see as true success in writing?
Yeah. What is success? That is a good one. I'm trying to think, we had him on, God, it's been a few years now. And I remember we dug into some of that. I actually dug into a lot on the writing with him.
Yeah.
And I actually received some at the time. So people were like, hey, I wish you know, dig more into the fishing. But I asked him about that. I said, hey, you know, do you think of yourself more as a writer or as a fisherman first? Right. And he thinks of himself as a writer.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, as much as he loves fishing, you know what I mean? Like, he is a writer first. And like, well, for you, I guess there you go. So right back at you. How do you see that question?
Yeah, I definitely see myself as a writer, because I don't just write about fishing. You know, I dabble in fiction. I'm still searching for that first published novel. But, you know, whether it's upland hunting, whether it's just traveling, sometimes it's just experiences in my life. Like, my default position, my factory setting is to write, I feel like, and reflect in that way.
Mm-hmm. Right on. And, yeah, I guess anything else you want to, you know, share here as far as, you know, some of the stuff you have going in your writing? You know, it's kind of interesting to me, because it sounds like that's something, a real focus for you. I mean, do you have another book that you're already thinking about, you know, coming out with, or how's all that look?
Yeah, definitely. I'd say halfway done maybe with the next book. And then I've got a few fiction projects that I've finished that I'm just trying to, you know, rework into something decent. But in terms of the next like outdoor book, I think it's going to be called Chasing the Dark, and it's going to be all about, you know, getting up to beat the sunrise, and how that type of passion is, inherent in a lot of outdoorsmen and kind of what that means.
Right. You mean chasing the dark. So basically like you're getting up at 1 a.m. sort of thing.
Just, yep.
Yeah. Chasing it.
Exactly. Yeah. Or, you know, staying out on the water or in the field, whatever the activity happens to be, even after the sun sets, you know? So,
yeah. What's your typical, are you, like in the summertime when you have light all day long, Do you find yourself just like sleeping a few hours? Do you have a hard time getting like a full night's sleep, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I do. It's because on the one hand, like a species like king salmon, for example, you're fishing late. So I typically don't start, you know, swinging flies for kings until like 10 or 11 p.m. And then you're swinging through to like 3 or 4 in the morning and then, you know, taking a nap and just trying to like while away the afternoon and evening, you know, maybe taking another nap until it's time to go fishing again. And then, you know, getting up early for trout and grayling, for example, maybe later when it actually is dark, that's getting up at 2 or 3 to drive, either drive where I'm going, or it's getting up at 3 or 4 just to get up and be, make sure I'm first on the stream and also that I'm beating the sun to the water, you know?
Oh, right. Yep.
So, but yeah, sleeping patterns become pretty erratic during the summertime. So
that's right.
You kind of take naps when you can and just generally walk around like a zombie
for
a bit of it. Yeah.
So you got the summer, so that's it. So you pretty much just don't sleep during the summer. And then in the wintertime you catch up because it's pretty much like right now it's January. So well, you're in Anchorage, so you have a little more of it, like sunlight per day. When does the sun pop out and when does it go down up there right now?
Oh, it probably comes out around 9:30 right now, and then it starts creeping back over 4:35 ish maybe.
Okay, so yeah, you got a good full day. But if you're up in Fairbanks, how would that be different right now?
Yeah, it'd probably be up 10:30, 11 o'clock, and then it'd be down at, you know, 3 or 4. And going to school and working in Fairbanks, that was always a bummer because like you'd get up and go to work in the dark, and you'd come home in the dark, and kind of miss all of the daylight. And it also makes it hard for like winter activities too. You know, like I do a lot of snowshoe hare hunting and ptarmigan hunting in the wintertime. And for me, who's used to getting up early and like being on the road to wherever I'm going super early, like now I don't have to leave until 8 or 9 in some cases. And it just feels like I've overslept in a case like that.
Right. Do you see the writing that you're doing as, do you have like a goal to be, you know, kind of like Gearock and a few of the other people out there where like you would be good if it was a full-time thing and you can go all in on that?
Yeah, definitely. My goal is kind of to publish a book, if not every year, every other year, and just kind of keep my conversation evolving, I guess, so to speak. But yeah, I don't think I would do well just, you know, sitting down and writing for 8 hours a day, but I think I'd do well, you know, exploring different avenues. Maybe I want to write about fishing, you know, for this month. Maybe I want to focus more on bird hunting. Maybe I want to focus on travel, you know, another time. I guess gathering experiences would be the main part of it, and learning new things, and then, you know, tying that all together with writing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you have some other articles out there, what you've written in a few other magazines. First on this Fly Fisherman, is that out there now? Do you remember the title of that one?
That one is not out. In fact, it might be a few months before it comes out, but yeah, it'll just be something along the lines of road system angling in Alaska.
Yeah.
I just recently had one published, I believe in the December edition of Fly Fisherman. It might be October, November. But that was actually about a trip I took down to Yakutat, Alaska, to fish for steelhead this past spring.
Oh, right. Yeah, Yakutat.
Yeah, that's world famous, of course, the SeaTac River down there.
How was that?
That was amazing. I mean, it was like almost life-changing. I know that sounds precious to say, but it really was an incredibly revelatory experience for me. I told a lot of people that was the hardest thing I've ever written, just by sheer nature of how much work it took, one, to catch fish, and two, just that place and kind of how controversial it has become, I guess I'll say.
Oh, Roy.
Yeah.
So first, why has it become controversial? And second, talk about how you get to Yakutat.
Yeah. So I guess first we'll talk about how to get to Yakutat, because that's easier. So it's down, you know, everyone when they're referencing Alaska, like, will put up their hand and make the rough shape of Alaska.
Yeah.
It's basically at the crook of your thumb, is where Yakutat is. So where Alaska starts splitting off into like all of the islands, and fjords of Southeast Alaska, basically right in the corner before that starts happening is Yakutat.
Okay.
So it's like an hour plane ride from Anchorage. I think it's like a 2 or 3 hour flight from something like Seattle. But yeah, it's a little village, with, with a runway that lands like 737s every day. So it's a pretty unique place.
Oh wow.
Yeah, but the controversial bit just comes, it came from me wanting to write this article. In fact, I had a lot of people that were, they got pretty angry with me when I said I was going to be writing about the SeaTuck. Because it's a special river, you know, it's the largest run of steelhead in the state, or it has been. And in terms of like the fish you can catch and the size of those fish, it's like unmatched, I feel like, anywhere else in the world. I mean, I know the Skeena gets way more fish, but it's a much bigger system. The SeaTuck's only 19 miles long. And it's more like a trout stream than a steelhead river. But it still gets runs of, you know, 5,000 plus fish. Some years it gets, you know, upwards of 10,000. That hasn't happened for several years, unfortunately. But just the pressure it gets. You know, the people that I mentioned were understandably upset just because they thought I was, you know, hot spotting a place and I was gonna blow up the fishery.
Right.
And like I say, I understand where they're coming from. The tack I tried to take kind of falls within what I mentioned is my writing style in general. I try and do more why to than how to. So I wasn't, you know, I wasn't giving them the entire rundown on how to go and catch tons of fish. I feel like the problem with that river is the expectations that people have, you know, because there are so many steelhead in the river, people like tout the figure. You can catch double digit steelhead in a day here, you know,
right.
10, 20, 30 steelhead. I've heard of 30 steelhead being caught in a day up there. You can catch 40 plus inch fish, which it's not that rare of a fish on the SeaTuck.
What's the technique you guys are doing there for catching them?
Yeah, you can fish swung flies. Like I mentioned, it's more like a trout stream than a steelhead river, but down lower, you can definitely spay fish, you know, swing some flies. We were actually fishing like egg sucking leeches and steelhead nymphs higher up.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to be the tactic. But of course they're steelhead, right? So they're moody when they want to be. And this is one of those times where we could not have timed it better. You know, and it had nothing to do with the way we planned it. We just lucked into some really amazing weather. And that was, the river was super low, like the week before we came, which, you know, steelhead, if the water's low and clear, like you're not going to catch many fish probably.
Is this like September?
This is May actually.
Oh, wow. May. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You're on the other end. Okay.
Yeah. So there is a fall run in like October, November actually, but the majority of the run comes in, April, May. I mean, March in some years they're steelhead, so they can be.
So these are kind of the spring winter fish.
Yeah. Yep. So yeah, super low and clear the week before we show up. They get a big push of rain, which that made the fishing and the exploring hard just because the water was higher, you know, fish are more spread out. But then it started to drop.
Yeah. Right.
And yeah, like I say, we could not have timed it more perfectly because there were more fish in. That big push of rain brought in more fish from the Pacific, and just the river was chock full of steelhead, and they were willing to indulge our presentations. So
there you go. So you had some steelhead. Do you have got a couple nice fish there?
Oh yeah. My fish of a lifetime by far. The last day we were there was kind of a buzzer beater fish, a 36 inch chrome hen that I managed to catch that just, I mean, like I say, it's precious to call something a life-changing fish, but that was a life-changing fish.
Yep. Just because it was a steelhead and it was, big, and you know, is that pretty much it, is like as far as the life change?
Well, that and just the whole experience. I mean, it's, as I wrote in that article for Fly Fisherman, it's so much more than the fish. That was just the icing on the cake, but you know, it's the river, it's the, you know, the river otters and the mink that you can see in any given day. It's the, you know, the varied thrushes singing in the canopy. It's, you know, the Tongass National Rainforest, like the biggest national forest in North America, and just these huge mossy trees. Like, just the environment is so incredible. And when I say life changing, I guess it's all of that together, but then it's also how it made me think about what I was going to write and then push out to the fly fishing world. Like I really thought back to, you know, those people that said I was going to blow up the blow up the fishery and ruin it with my writing. And I made the article way more about, you know, appreciating where you are, like being actually striving more for a one fish day than a 10 fish day.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that's exactly how my day was. That was the one and only fish I caught. And cool. I was fine with that.
Yeah. That's all you need. Yeah. That's the thing about fishing is that, yeah, sometimes you just need one, you know.
Exactly.
And that's probably a lot of these fisheries or, you know, species that, you know, I mean, you get one of those and that'll keep you going for a long time. I mean, you could probably call it good right after that.
Exactly. Yeah. And like the size of the fish, 36-inch steelhead. I mean, it's a nice steelhead, but, you know, if it was a 30-inch steelhead, I think it would have been equally life-changing just because of the experience surrounding it, you know.
Right. So that was like, you had a mid-teen, 16-pound fish or something like that.
Yeah, she was beautiful, we'll say that.
Yeah, right on. Nice. Well, let's take it out of here. We've got this 2-minute drill we've been doing here just to kind of get me on track and take us out of here. So let's start this.
Yeah.
You got you ready to take it out of here?
Yes, let's do this.
This is my chance to do the rapid fire round, which I used to do, but I never would keep it very rapid. So we're gonna start the clock and go. Okay, so we mentioned, and some of these are going to be tough, so we might have to circle back around with you, but outdoor writing ethics, you kind of hinted on a little bit. What would you say if you had a one word or two to talk about that?
Probably go straight with my writing philosophy, why to versus how to.
Good. What's the up there? Are there any conservation issues or groups or anybody you would highlight from the work you've done?
Trout Unlimited, definitely a good one to be involved with. And then Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. They do a lot of neat conservation stuff up here. That's, you know, we talked earlier in the show about kings, and that's obviously a pretty predominant issue up here, is diminishing king runs. But, and then of course steelhead, you know, down in Southeast, some of the diminishing steelhead runs there.
That's big too.
I feel like those things need to be addressed. And that's kind of why I proceeded with writing that CTUC article I mentioned, is because I feel like it needs to be highlighted. Like the problem needs to be highlighted and we need to adjust our expectations. So.
Yeah. Good. If you're sitting around, you know, we're doing the fireside chat after that 2020 trip.
Yeah.
I'm thinking it's October and you're doing a summary looking back. What's the story you're going to kind of refresh and tell? If you had the microphone in front of you right now, you're like, okay, this is the one thing I remember from that year.
Oh, probably. I did a 12-mile hike through mosquito infested swamp to get to the northernmost rainbow trout in America, or in North America for that matter. Yeah.
Northernmost. So you're up above Fairbanks.
Actually, that was south of Fairbanks. So there are no native rainbow trout north of the Alaska Range. Mm. So I've been told, that have been documented, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so the population I was going for was in the Gulkana River, which is basically the headwaters are right south of the Alaska Range.
Gotcha.
And so I hiked in, because that's a very famous river for rafting. In fact, anybody that's coming up here to fly fish the road system, that's a super amazing and fairly remote feeling raft trip, and you can access, you know, put in and take out points from the road system. So, that's my story. I hiked in because I didn't have a raft, and that hike involved some pretty hellish conditions.
Yeah, gosh, sounds like okay. And what about, you know, as far as the road system, we've talked about a little bit on it. Any other resources or, you know, things you'd recommend for somebody if they're planning that trip, you know, this summer heading up there?
Yeah, good question. So this is one I forgot to mention earlier. Grab a copy of Gunnar Peterson's Highway Angler. You can find it on Amazon. Try and get the latest edition if you can. I don't know how many there are now, but that's like the Bible to have. It goes over every road that there is in the state. It tells you exactly which streams you can access, what's in them, you know, like the general quality of the fishing, and then like what tactics are used. So that's, it literally is a Bible for roadside fishing up here.
Wow. Perfect. Okay. That's it. So that's a great link. You mentioned a quote from Gearock earlier. Do you have another quote you would recommend you want to highlight here that we could put in the show notes, or do you want to just remind us on that one you talked about earlier?
Yeah, sure. I can, I mean, the other quote I have is about writing. I mean, it could apply to fishing too, I guess. But yeah, that one, the one from Gearox, I don't know. I just think really, really poignant. And again, that one is, you could say the same thing about fishing that they say about baseball, that it takes a kid, or that it takes an adult to play the game well, but it takes a kid to think it's important.
Yeah, that's it. That's the one. That is a good, yeah. That's the quote that'll go out there. Okay. And what about, so we're taking our trip up, you know, driving around Alaska, and we're putting in a tune. You're going to be putting in a tune in the, you know, grabbing Spotify, grabbing your favorite tune. What is that tune, or what is the band, or what is the group? What would you add there? We could put in the show notes.
Oh, probably Rock of Ages by Def Leppard.
Okay. Yeah. Nice. Def Leppard.
Yeah. I've tied various versions of a swinging fly I call the Def Leppard, and it's almost to the point where I'm totally happy with it. In fact, my first king salmon on the swing came on this Def Leppard fly that I tie. So that's one of my favorite bands, and yeah, pretty special fly for me now. And actually, I hooked my first spay king on this fly. Did not land that fish, but I at least hooked my first spay king on the Def Leppard.
Oh, you did good. All right, Def Leppard's good, and nice. Well, as we look out, it's kind of January, looking out over the next kind of 6 months, year. What's it look like for you? I mean, what are you doing right now through the winter? What's keeping you busy? Are you just kind of writing all the time?
Trying to write as much as I can, you know, get this next book published. And if I can put in a little plug for that, the SeaTuck story that they shared about those steelhead, there's going to be a fairly extensive chapter all about that trip in my next book. So if anyone's at all interested, be looking for that. But
yeah. And when will that book, just estimating, when would you say that book's going to be out?
Oh, I mean, just going by the sometimes glacial pace of publishing, it might be late 2023. I doubt it. Probably more like 2024.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Well, we'll circle back around and add a link at a later point in the show notes. And right on, Joe. We'll all, you know, we'll put at josephdjacksonwriter.com.
Yes, sir.
We'll send everybody out if they have questions, want to pick up your books. And yeah, just want to thank you for all your time today and shedding some light on the Alaska highway system. It's kind of daunting, I think, when you first think about Alaska, right? But for me, you know, I mean, I just want to get back up there and do more, and even thought about, like, hey, what would it be like to live up there? So appreciate you shedding some light on that today, and for all your time.
Yeah, hopefully it was some light that I shed, and not just more obscurity. But yeah, it's worth it. It requires some work to, you know, find your own honey holes, but that's part of the lure of fishing, right? Like asking questions and then attempting to answer them. So
exactly. Right on. All right, we'll keep in touch and talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks a lot, Dave. I appreciate it.
So there you go. Coming back down, made our trip up north to Alaska. We headed past Fairbanks, drove on that highway. We almost ran out of gas a couple of times. But as Joseph said, there's ways to prepare for the trip. We had our two spare tires, so we were good to go. Glad you're on this journey today. I hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you want to get all the show notes, wetflyswing.com/412. 412, 412 will get you those links and some of the show notes. Quick listener shout out before we get out of here, Rick Kuhn. Rick reached out and said he has been loving the podcast and listening while he's tying flies behind the vise and on the road. And he mentioned that he'd love to have Josh from the Gates Asabo Lodge on the podcast. So we're going to do our best to get Josh on the podcast, and want to thank Rick for checking in and for the support. If you want to get a shout out on this podcast and want us to put together a podcast, you can connect with me anytime. On social, or send me an email, dave@wetflyswing.com. If you are listening right now and haven't connected with me, now's the time. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to try to put together an episode, or just say hi. Let me know where you're coming from. I always love to hear what part of the country, potentially world, you're coming from. If you're outside the United States, I would love to hear if you're in one of those countries that we know we have listeners, but we don't always hear from people. So give a shout out, dave@wetflyswing.com. All right, where are we going next? Let's take a look. I actually don't even have to take too much of a look, because we know we are heading into the Euronymphing School. So next week, we have a big week. We've got our head man, Pete Erickson, coming on to dig into Euronymphing. We're going to get in a bunch of tips and tricks next week, talk about this big event we have going, talk about some of the gear that we are giving away. We're also going to dig into some of the Henry's Fork. We're going to talk to the Henry's Fork Foundation. And we're also going to chat with Maverick Founder, the Maverick Founder, who has some really interesting stuff going in the Euro Niffing game, specialized reel and rods for this amazing type of fishing that we're going to be going full in next week. It's Euro week, Euro Niffing week next week. Stay tuned. That's the big one. I'm going to leave it there, and I am going to start to pack it up out of here. It's a good evening. I got a bunch of other things to do. We're going to be getting some more podcast content ready for this next week. So if you get a chance, check in on that Euro School. I would love to connect with you on that trip. It's going to be come up later in the year, and I'd love to connect with you online if we're not going to do the trip. So reach out, let me know. And I hope you are having a good evening, a good morning, or good afternoon, wherever in the world you are. And I hope to talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Wet Fly Swing Fly Fishing Show. For notes and links from this episode, visit wetflyswing.com.